Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, this is John Williams, and you are about to hear the Mincing Rascals podcast recorded after a day that may live to some degree in infamy. Also, at the end of this podcast, we post three conversations we had earlier today on January 7th, 2021, with Illinois congressmen and women who were in the Capitol when the Capitol was stormed. That's where the Mincing Rascals start, those bonus tracks, if you will, at the very end. Those were some harrowing and insightful experiences and conversations at the end of this podcast. By the way, before we get rolling, roll on over to the Joint Relief Institute. They're the sponsor of the Mincing Rascals podcast. We couldn't do this without them, and we sure appreciate their support for our little pod and also for your knees. Look, if you've got joint pain, I want you to go to maybe their new location in Northbrook. Is that easier for you? They are in Orland Park. They're in Oakbrook and now in Northbrook, too. They'll use digital imaging at either location. They'll see where the tissue in your knee has worn away, and then they put a lubricant into that spot. I'm telling you, it worked in 2020, and it'll work again in 2021. So if you're planning on doing any walking this year, or getting in and out of your car, or in and out of bed, or going up and down stairs and your knee hurts, you should really give these people a try. It's a quick, non-surgical, pain-free procedure that I'll bet your insurance is going to pay for, too. JointReliefInstitute.com. Or call this number, 708-888-0000. We like to say 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. Now our snappy open. Today is Thursday, January 7th, 2021, the strangest year ever. I'm John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals, the weekly podcast we record throughout Chicagoland via Zoom. We are heard not just in Chicagoland, but across at least two states. If you're listening to us somewhere, let us know where. I'm John Williams at WGNradio.com. And you can hear me weekdays from 9 to noon on WGN.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTPW News.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the vastly relieved columnist from the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, I think we all are too, Eric. Yesterday might not be December 7th or November 11th, but January 6th. May well go down as one of the darker and long-remembered dates in American history. After their Stop the Steal rally, at which the president and his allies told the crowd the election had been stolen from them and that they needed to do combat, protesters stormed the Capitol. They interrupted the counting of the electoral ballots. We are told that four people died, one woman was shot, and three others from medical emergencies. The president's Facebook account has been suspended, and his last two tweets have not just been flagged, but have been blocked. He has not made an available comment then to the American people in almost 24 hours now. He is, as we sit here, AWOL. The votes were counted, though, and Joe Biden has won as expected in the Electoral College, awaiting now only his inauguration in 2 weeks. So today, there is talk about invoking the 25th Amendment or trying to again impeach the president. I know we have a lot to talk about, but let's just start there, guys. My advice is to gird your loins, cross your fingers, and ride this thing out. Do you agree with me that this talk about getting Donald Trump out of office with 2 weeks left, do you think that we should entertain efforts to remove Trump in the next 2 weeks?
I personally think there should be a vote to impeach based on the events of yesterday. So if you have someone who has... And this is going to sound like such a flippant comparison based on what's happened in the past day, but it was an image that popped into my head this morning. You know, in Office Space where Milton finally learns that he is fired and he burns the building down.
Yeah.
That I'm reminded of a disgruntled employee with, you know, a lot more power than a guy with a stapler.
A red stapler.
A red stapler, exactly. And the fact that you'd had someone who for 6 months or so said the election was going to be stolen after the election continued to make remarks that he won in a landslide, that called for people to come to the Capitol on January 6th, and then at his speech told those people to go to the Capitol, and then either by an error of omission or commission did not adequately have, you know, fulfill a national security obligation to protect the people in that building and to protect this hall of power in the United States, I think is plenty of grounds to justify a vote for impeachment. And I actually think it could even be in Republicans' best interests to do that. So that's where I'm at with it, you know, 24 hours after the fact.
How about you, Heather?
I will say that I have yet to figure out or read any reporting about how it was that the president was not in the chain of command for the decision that deployed the National Guard to the United States Capitol yesterday. So by all accounts, the president declined to issue that order when asked to do so by his aides. And then those aides, including the acting defense secretary, went to Vice President Pence, who then issued the order. Now, I play a constitutional scholar on podcasts and television, but I am relatively sure that that is not how it is supposed to work. So if the president is not acting in the chain of command, then the American people should be informed of that, and it should be clear what that constitutional chain of command is.
Well, if the job of the president is to uphold the Constitution and not doing so as grounds for impeachment, I think you could point to a number of failures by the president, including not acknowledging the legitimacy of the vote as a failure to uphold the Constitution. Eric, where are you on all of this?
Well, it does seem to me that he has not been fulfilling the duties of the presidency ever since the election, that he has let this the vaccine distribution, for instance, go by the wayside. I can't think of a single thing that he's done really to fulfill the office of president in since the election. So he's not really acting in that chain of command that Heather talks about anyway. And I think this is the reason why the 25th Amendment is coming into play. Now, the 25th Amendment, I only play a constitutional scholar for podcast purposes, but my sense of it is that it is there to deal with a situation in which the president has a stroke or comes down with a severe illness. So for instance, if Trump's COVID had been far worse than it was, that's really what the 25th Amendment is for, that it is not there to take away the powers of a president who is just acting in a deranged and reckless fashion, which is what Trump is doing. Impeachment really is the remedy for that, and I would agree with Austin on that, except the fact that we are entering a 13-day period now that seems very perilous, and the impeachment process, no matter how quickly you try to do it, is going to take longer than a few days. And I think the idea behind invoking the 25th Amendment is to get him out of office the way Twitter got him off the platform immediately, and say he is unfit, he is mentally unfit to serve as president. It would create a kind of an odd precedent. But given that you have to have the consent of the cabinet I believe it's 2/3 of the Congress, both houses of Congress.
And the vice president.
And the vice president and the cabinet to do this, that it's not like the next president's going to come along and they go, oh, you know, he's acting goofy. That's a strange policy that he's endorsing. Let's invoke the 25th Amendment. I don't think that's a danger. It would be a very unusual use of the 25th Amendment. The Tribune just on Thursday afternoon has posted a very strong editorial calling for the 25th Amendment to be invoked. Adam Kinzinger has the Republican congressman from the suburbs here.
Yeah.
Has called for it.
Excuse me, Eric, do you think that that's ceremonial? They know that won't happen, but it's just a posture that you take to express the gravity of the situation.
I don't know that it won't happen. I know that Elaine Chao, the transportation secretary in the cabinet, has resigned today.
Why?
On Thursday. I think as an expression. Well, she is, of course, married to Mitch McConnell. And I think Mitch McConnell has clearly yesterday separated himself from the president, as did Mike Pence.
Bill Barr.
So I'm thinking that this is just people deciding that they're going to try to. Think of Lindsey Graham's speech last night. Did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Where he all of a sudden, after all these years, he's now distancing himself from Trump. And I think you're seeing a lot of people fleeing Trump right now in Washington. And my guess is that you're going to see that around the country as well, that this, the MAGA support, it will always be there, but I think it's going to shrink at this point. I think that this, as someone said, maybe it popped the balloon on the belief in Trump, that he is going to be seen as this feckless, sore loser, and that his era of aura of invincibility is gone.
Sure damaged the brand, didn't he? I mean, there was talk yesterday that Lara Trump might want to run for politics. We always thought maybe Ivanka or Don Jr. might want to cash in on their dad's cachet, but maybe there's a hell of a lot less today. Mark Baser, who's sat with us on this podcast before, said 14 days left and these people now are leaving the White House. They should give 2 weeks' notice. Now they get religion. Maybe you would be sympathetic to that, guys, because it has, sort of like Twitter and Facebook, it has been such a sort of gradual spin. So when does he cross the line? When is his tweet too dangerous or too inaccurate that you can't host it or post it? The last two things that he put up on Twitter that were blocked, I saw.
I know your pain. I know you're hurt. We had an election that was stolen from us. It was a landslide election, and everyone knows it, especially the other side. But you have to go home now.
And I don't think there was a marked distinction between them and previous things he had posted.
They took down the video, two tweets, and then blocked him for 12 hours, right?
Yeah, but he hasn't posted since.
So they blocked two tweets and said that Trump has to delete three tweets before they would unblock his account after 12 hours. The president or his staff has not done so. So his account has not been unblocked.
The point on sort of where the line was crossed, I think, is actually a really important one. It goes to Eric's discussion about the efficacy of invoking the 25th Amendment versus impeachment proceedings. I do think it sets a bad precedent for the 25th, invoking the 25th Amendment for something like someone being mentally unstable. Like, that's a very difficult precedent. Whereas impeachment, you know, the charges are clear. It's Congress, the will of the people is heard in those votes. I think the line is crossed, and the way in which it is extraordinary is that it was a clear incitement to political violence explicitly with the goal of disrupting the peaceful transition of power.
Especially in combination with what Rudy Giuliani said from that same stage and what Donald Trump Jr. said from that stage about, you know, if you don't vote the way we want you to, we'll be in your backyards, I think is the way he put it. This has crossed yet another line. I mean, as though he hasn't crossed every other line that's been drawn for him. But again, impeachment requires a process. I mean, the articles of impeachment have to be filed, then they go over to the Senate. The Senate has to have a trial. How quickly can you possibly do that? And still make it look like a fair process. You can't say, hey, we're gonna impeach you today and try you tomorrow. That looks like a kangaroo court.
I just don't think as a practical matter you could accomplish either of them. And you hate to give the guy a pass, but really, what's the end game here? Let's just get to the 20th of January and let's have as smooth a transition as possible, an impeachment or a 25th article hanging over the process. I honestly don't. I'll finish this thought and then disagree with myself. I honestly don't think that serves America's best interest, at least not in the short term. In the long term, yeah, he gets away with it. But what are you trying to do here? Punish Donald Trump or salvage the year and move forward?
Well, he has access to the nuclear codes.
I mean, the thing is, like, really? Eric?
So what?
No, I mean, really, so what? What do you think he's going to do?
Can the producers please flag this tape so that in 1 week when we're back here in the smoking ruins of Chicago?
Do you think he's going to drop a bomb on Iran or Canada?
Not Canada, but Iran, possibly, yeah. But the thing is, like, he has a lot of power. The president of the United States has a lot of power, and he can do a lot of damage in 13 days. I would say it's not just like, well, you know, we'll humor him on his way out the door, because there is too much danger in that. I worry about it. I really do. I was not as worried until things happened yesterday, and I realized that he does have this crazy army of people behind him, and he knows no guardrails.
I would suggest that if we could go back in time a week ago, and if you had asked us, do you think that there's going to be violence on January 6th? I think that a lot of people probably would have said, it's going to be fine. I mean, they're going to get some people, they're going to yell, they're going to scream, but they'll eventually go away. And I think that that would have been 100% wrong. And I think that when you hear yourself saying, well, what's the worst that could happen? I think that it's incumbent to remember those pictures of the Confederate flag being flown through the Capitol yesterday, that the American flag was replaced with the Trump flag, that there was, you know, there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 Capitol police officers in the hospital as we speak Thursday afternoon. You know, it's been pretty much almost, you know, 4.5 years of people saying, well, what's the worst that can happen? And it just seems to me that we keep pushing that bar for the worst. It's you know, something that people who deal with victims of abuse who warn that the most dangerous time is right when sort of the situation changed, when the abuser is about to be forced to leave, or when, you know, something's about to change. And I would suggest humbly that that is very, very equivalent to what we are in now.
That's an interesting analogy.
There is a lot of peril in the future here. And, you know, Heather's right when she talks about the fact that when we thought about what was going to happen yesterday, I think we all assumed, well, there's going to be some rumpus on the streets of Washington. That's for sure. There was some protests before where the Proud Boys were stabbing people or being stabbed. I can't remember who was stabbing who there, but that there was no way that we were going to see the security perimeter of the Capitol breached. And yet it happened, which is sort of a different subject right now, but it is an outrage what happened there. And, you know, heads have got to roll. You can't have a Capitol Police Force and the National Guard, everyone, be surprised by something that was signaled weeks ago. This wasn't a spontaneous, this wasn't like protests after George Floyd. This was something that Trump had told people, see you in Washington on January 6th.
Yeah.
We knew this was coming, and yet they were basically opening the doors for protesters or terrorists, as I call them, in the Capitol. So you know, the idea that Trump could declare martial law and order a new election. I mean, I don't know where this puts us into all kinds of constitutional territory that we have not yet been in. But, you know, there are constitutional crises that are looming here. And I just think the safest thing to do, even though it maybe sets a slightly lousy precedent, is to invoke this 25th Amendment and say this guy is not mentally fit to be the president. Probably never was. But
have the Capitol Police released anything yet today explaining the situation? Because as of this morning, I was looking at some of their stuff, and what was that explanation?
They said they were prepared for people to exercise their First Amendment rights to protest, but that they were not prepared for a violent assault on the Capitol. That indicates a failure of just being acquainted with the facts. But I want to caution and say that it is very similar to what you just said, John. Well, what harm could they do? The Capitol Police thought. How bad could it get? They thought. And that's what happened. Nancy Pelosi just announced that the head of the Capitol Police had resigned at her request, and that both the sergeant at arms for the House and the Senate had been relieved of their duties. So this is not just on, of course, the Capitol Police. It was a systematic effort. And I would say that in another lifetime, I covered Capitol Hill very briefly, and the security arrangements, and this was pre 9/11, so I'm dating myself here, but it boggles my mind. I mean, I got yelled at for being on the wrong side of a velvet rope.
Well, I'm wondering if there's going to be some expression of complicity, if they're going to find that they were so able to breach the line is because there was some kind of tacit cooperation, and it wasn't just to minimize the harm to these citizens, but to kind of let them have their say.
You've seen the TikTok of the guard posing for a selfie with one of the invaders. And there's also some images that I've seen of the guards opening up the security gates. The barriers and just pulling them apart and letting the people rush through. I don't know if this was some sort of jujitsu form of crowd control. It's hard to say what they might have been up to there. But I had not heard, and thanks, Heather, for that they had gotten the resignation of those people. Because I think that may just be the beginning of it. And perhaps in the Biden administration, they can conduct a thorough review of what happened.
Oh, there needs to be a 9/11 style investigation. You're going to get a 1,500-page report don't you think, about what happened yesterday?
It doesn't have to be mutually exclusive to say that some officers perhaps treated these insurrectionists, for lack of a better term, better than they would have treated other types of protesters. But you can also make an argument that they were overwhelmed. And there's certainly video enough to show that they were overwhelmed at points and just wholly unprepared. So I want to, you know, keep us away from sort of saying this is the explanation and it applies, you know, over the entire incident. Because I think both can be true.
Yeah, I mean, you could imagine a situation where a guard feels like that to calm things down, to smooth over what's going on and make people, you know, a little less angry, that he'll be friendly to them and pose for a selfie in order just that he's not trying to signal some sort of alliance with them, but just trying to calm the situation. And again, you're right, the individual officers, you never know, but the fact that the entire force was really outmanned, underprepared, unprepared for this is scandalous. And and boy, those images that we saw of these people running wild through the Capitol and sitting at Nancy Pelosi's desk and occupying the well of the Senate, just horrifying. I mean, and it was embarrassing, right? Around the world, these images are going. And this is the United States, which holds itself up as this exceptional place where democracy flourishes, and we don't engage in these kind of crazy things that you see from these third world countries. And yet, that's what we saw. So
it was embarrassing, among other things. But do you think, though, that once they made the mistake of letting these people get through, that at least they did not escalate it? The police, when I was watching the pummeling they were taking, the abuse they were taking, and we didn't know what was going on inside, but I thought they were showing a lot of restraint with that crowd, not obeying orders, hurling all sorts of things at them. The police could have opened up in a whole lot of ways on that crowd. We can get to what would they have done if that was a Black Lives Matter protest. But just for the moment, the police did show a lot of restraint. That thing could have been 1,000 times worse in terms of injuries to civilians.
And I think it plays a key role in kind of the narrative around what actually took place around the escalation, right? If they were poorly prepared for something like this, you know, any type of like classic crowd control stuff, once they breach into the place itself and you're overwhelmed, what is there to do if you're not prepared? There's nothing you could have can. It's very difficult to effectively get those folks to leave without escalating very quickly to violence. And this is one point I think about. You hear from like the Trumpiest of Trump fans right now that it was a wherever they like heard this before, it was a mostly peaceful protest. So a lot of people were actually just there peacefully. And that may even be true, even though they're wrong, right? I mean, there's no evidence the election was stolen. There's no evidence of widespread voter fraud. But that doesn't excuse what the president did and didn't do. He did foment this conspiracy theory. He did incite people to go to the Capitol to disrupt this peaceful transition of power. And then after they did it, the video that he puts out is, which we haven't gotten to yet, was justifying their whole reason for being there and their reason for the violence, which is that the election was stolen and that I won in a landslide. And that to me is and then he loved them. And if you really didn't want that to happen, if you didn't want to see what took place happen, that's not what you would say. That's not the first thing you would say out of your mouth is justifying their reason for being there in the first place. And that's the grounds for the impeachment vote, in my opinion.
It was amazing how you contrast that speech with Biden's speech or with Mike Pence's speech or with Mitch McConnell's speech. I mean, there were some great speeches. I watched a lot of that debate last night or Wednesday night. And the speeches coming from both sides of the aisle were really amazing compared to what Trump said. Trump was basically, you know, egging them on and saying, yeah, this is stolen from us and they're bad and evil people who've done this, but we got to be peaceful. And it's essentially the reason that he gave for being peaceful was that it was strategic. It wasn't because it was the right thing to do. We can't let them see us this way.
Right.
It was a shameful speech, and he totally missed that moment.
He also characterized them as special people, and that he loves them. I mean,
yeah.
go ahead, Eric, but I mean...
Well, so that's what you say to your drunk friend when you put him into an Uber after a party.
That's like, you're a special person and I love you.
I love you. Now go home. That's what he said. Go home.
Go home. You have to go home. But Austin's right. I mean, in the process of telling people to go home, he reminded them that the reason they have to go home is because something precious is being stolen from them. So he was playing it not even both ways. He was clearly continuing to incite their passions, even while he was saying the words, go home. That is not how that message was received. It's not why that was taken down from Twitter. It is, and by the way, guys, so literally here we're sitting here at 2:03 in the afternoon. The president has not gone on national television. He hasn't done a Oval Office, White House desk speech to the American people. Think about that. He is absent from the dialogue. We're going on 24 hours now. It's posting a one-way video, which has since been made unavailable. I know you can hear it. We just did hear, but that's pretty amazing. I don't know where he is. I don't know what he's thinking. I don't know what pressures are being brought to bear upon him. And if he had a moment to just try and salvage this thing by saying something appropriate, it's now. Every moment that goes by that he isn't in front of a TV camera, and I'm not sure that Sean Hannity tonight counts, but maybe he'll pop up there. He has to address the American people. He has not.
How many moments like this has he missed, though? I think we've spoken on this podcast several times about how the pandemic gave him a real chance to reset his image as a leader. And he blew that. He blew the aftermath of Charlottesville. He messed that one up. I can't even think of a moment that he has met as a leader. So for us, we can be disappointed yet again, but we certainly can't be surprised that he hasn't seen an opportunity here to at least begin to repair the damage that he has done. But that's Trump, right? And, we got 13 more days to get through here.
Let's just pick a couple of other random observations from the last 24 hours of things you heard or saw that somewhat surprised you or you thought were noteworthy, anecdotes, if nothing else. I visited with three members of the Congress from Illinois today. One of them, Sherry Bustos from the 17th Congressional District, told us about how under each seat of a member in Congress is an emergency kit, including a gas mask, and that they were told, get your gas masks out. She said, I've been in the Congress for 5 terms. I didn't know how to do this thing. So she's opening up a Tupperware container and fiddling with the thing she's never had to touch in her life.
Seeing Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor say something like that failed insurrection or just terms like that boggle your mind. The fact that you're watching a leader of the free world say terms like that in a speech was truly surreal. It was really, really remarkable. Mm-hmm. And I was also remembering Eric brought up Lindsey Graham. He said Lindsey Graham said in 2016, whatever benefit that is gained by beating Hillary Clinton with a person of this character will be paid back double in the consequences to the sort of the Republican brand nationally. And that has absolutely been the case.
Right. And we could credit Lindsey Graham with great insight if he hadn't then reversed himself so quickly and so spectacularly to become a coat holder for Trump for all these years. And I think this comes from this belief that some people in Washington have, which is that if you just get close to Trump, that you can be someone who sets some of the guardrails, that you can influence him to behave well if you're on the inside.
Right.
Plus you get the benefit of the support of all of his followers. Lindsey Graham, I think, sold his soul to be close to Trump, as I think Mike Pence did. And I was pleased by what I heard both of them say and what I heard Mitch McConnell say yesterday. It was like living in a wonderful republic yesterday to hear those people.
I'm surprised I'm glad to hear that, Eric. I'm surprised that you were calmed by that. I just thought that was hypocrisy coming from those guys.
When I was watching Pence speak, when Pence opened the evening session with a speech, he asked for leave to make remarks, which I think is maybe a little irregular. But he gave the opening remarks to the evening session of the Senate, and he was talking about what a terrible thing had happened that afternoon. And I kept waiting for him to say, however, I kept waiting for him to turn to, we know this election, to say something that he was going to, give Trump a little smooch and give his supporters this feeling of like they're airing their grievances and so on. But he didn't. And when he finished and didn't do that, I was like, this is what we have needed to hear all along. Where has this been?
I don't know.
Where has this been for 4 years?
But you can't wash the stain away, Eric. It stays
I'm not
on.
I'm not saying you can, but I was dreading the fact that the stain was still just going to be made worse. Hmm. So I'm not naive about it, and I don't shelve my cynicism, but I was glad to at least hear them saying the right things last night, and I think that may have contributed to sort of calming the atmosphere today, such as it is in Washington. We're not seeing a repeat of these riots, mm-hmm. and so on. So, I think that it may, in the long run, be the thing that ends up shoving Trump out the door. That I believe the Republican Party at this point goes like, this guy is not the horse that we want to ride into 2024.
So I have some really bad news for you, Eric.
Oh, no.
So the president called in this morning to the Republican National Committee, which is going on right now. And he was greeted with cheers and calls of, we love you.
You're serious.
As reported by the Washington Post. He did not address what happened yesterday at the Capitol, nor was he asked about it. So I am sorry to say that is just that expectation is not supported by any facts that we've seen.
Not yet. I do think though that we are seeing the beginning of the end here. I think that this cheering for him, I come back in 6 months and let's take a look at the polls in 6 months. I saw what percentage of Republicans said they supported the invasion of the Capitol yesterday? It was something in the 40s.
Right. Well, I think a more telling statistic is the fact that 65% of the Congressional Republican Caucus, both in the House and the Senate, voted to overturn the election results in Arizona and in Pennsylvania. That's who the Republican Party is right now. So if you want to say like the Republican Party is split 60-40, I think there's evidence to suggest that. I think that's pretty sobering, actually.
But only six of them voted to overturn the
results. I'm talking Senate and House.
But in the Senate, only six out of, what was it, 52 Republicans or 51? Only six out of 51 of them voted.
Well, so it wasn't 51 because Perdue is no longer a senator.
Okay. But a small percentage in the Senate. So
there were seven Republican senators who said they would vote to overturn election results who ended up not doing that.
But how many members in the House did? That was still a
121.
Can you believe that? I mean, forget about the Senate for a minute. Those are members of Congress. After the fact, they still voted that way.
And I think that speaks to what his lasting influence will be if there is not leadership. I mean, from someone like McConnell right now, in terms of impeachment and speaking in the strongest possible terms, you're going to see Republican primaries, coming up in the next couple of years. And a Trump endorsement is either going to mean a great deal, a lot, because the Republican Party is still embracing him at the highest levels and didn't do everything it could to distance itself from him. Or you could see that endorsement not mean as much. Wow. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that he is a massive player in electoral politics in 2 to 4 years, depending on what is done right now.
Well, I know I live in a blue city and a blue county and a blue state. But if I was a member of the Congress, in 2 years I had to run if I'm in the House, I would not feel real good about hitching my wagon to Donald Trump right now. And that's what these guys did, right, Austin?
Yeah, two Illinois Republican congressmen, I believe, voted to, that was Bost, and please remind me the other, was it Davis?
Not Miller, not LaHood.
No, Mary Miller did vote to overturn both Arizona and...
Oh, she did. She was one of them.
Miller and Bost.
She said that's what Hitler would have wanted.
Yeah. Here's the soundbite from Mary Miller. This was the day before, though.
It was hours before.
Hours? It was the same day?
Same day.
You know, if we win a few elections, we're still going to be losing unless we win the hearts and minds of our children. Hitler was right on one thing. He said, whoever has the youth has the future.
What are we to make of that? I don't know a lot about her. She went to Naperville High. She went to Eastern Illinois University, so she was kind of from the Chicagoland area. Now she lives in East Central Illinois, in what is it, Oakland, Illinois. She's a member of the Congress, replaced Shimkus down there. She was reading from prepared remarks, so she calls Hitler's name and says that, you know, we need to learn from him that you need to capture the youth's hearts if you want to be successful. I forget who it was, but they said, oh, there was a Whitney Houston song.
Children are our future?
Yeah. if you want to quote somebody who knows that children are our future, use Whitney Houston, not Adolf Hitler.
So you know what? John Wayne Gacy was a bad guy, but as a clown, he
exactly
he was entertaining.
Bozo, you've used Bozo. Does anybody have any other comment other than what a stupid, inane, inappropriate thing to say?
Never cite Hitler in a favorable way. It's the clear rule.
I was surprised when I tweeted Governor Pritzker's condemnation of his remarks. I was surprised. I thought it was worth pointing out that he is Jewish and that it has got to be incredibly painful for a Jewish American to stand up there and have to denounce Hitler after a remark like that by another member of the Illinois congressional delegation. And the amount of pushback I got on Twitter saying that it was inappropriate to point that out was just really frightening and disturbing, frankly. And
inappropriate to point out that Pritzker's Jewish? Is that
correct?
Why did they say that? I don't get it.
Can't everybody be appalled by a Hitler, Eric?
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I mean, really, do the Jewish people actually have, you know, an especial pain about Hitler? To which, of course, I replied,
Yes, I think we do. I think so, yeah.
Well, the very first comments we got on the radio today about this whole topic was, okay, but you guys sure seem to champion when the cities were burning the right to protest. So what's with this media bias now that you're critical of this sacking of the Capitol?
Yeah. Whataboutism is alive and well, and it's just not worth engaging in because there's never a response that's going to make the other person go, oh, yes, actually, you're correct. Thank you. I stand correct.
They invaded the Capitol building of the United States government. They didn't just, you know, grab some stuff off the shelves at a Walmart. I mean, and both are bad, but I think the scale of what happened yesterday was symbolically and realistically was much worse. They were attacking the seat of our government in an attempt to overthrow a free and fair election.
Right,
that's
right.
A lot different than you know, even burning down a police station, which most people did decry that violence. Yeah, there were some people on the left who like to excuse the looting and the vandalism. I'm not one of those. I don't know if anyone on this panel is one of those people, but it's not acceptable to do that. But what happened yesterday was way worse.
No, but let's just talk about that for a second. There was a Black Lives Matter representative in Chicago who described the looting as reparations. In both instances, you can have both things. You do have legitimate protesters. If you're so angry about the results of an election, walk right up to the Capitol and scream and wave signs. We need to protect that. We need to encourage, if you feel that way, the opportunity to vigorously protest. And then there were people that sacked the Capitol and are felons. The same thing happened in Chicago and other cities. There were a lot of mostly people were safely protesting legally, civilly, and then there were people who were not. So there is that comparison, right? Heather, are you shaking your head?
Oh, no, I agree with you.
No, there's no question. I mean, I think in both cases, most of the protesters were not violent. When you talk about the after George Floyd, there were a lot of people who were protesting that who were out on the streets who were appalled by the looting and the violence in that situation. And I'm sure that there were people who were in Washington yesterday who were really angry and upset and appalled by the fact that some of their people had gone into the Capitol and really took the entire thing off message, way off message. And that's why I think that out in the heartland is squandered feelings of those warm feelings that people might have had for MAGA and for Trump. And so when we're talking, again, to circle a little bit back to what happens in 2022, when someone comes to, LaHood and some of these people and says, hey, what were you doing? How did you cast that vote? They can say, well, you know, all we were doing was asking them to take a strong because I wasn't necessarily supporting Trump. I was supporting democracy. And they'll be able to spin that without any problem.
Are you, Eric, are you saying that vote won't be a problem in 2022?
I'm guessing that it will not alienate your mainstream moderate Republicans. You'll be able to spin it to them saying, you know what, this wasn't about Trump, it was about the sanctity of the ballot and so on.
Moderate Republicans, that might play with Trump Republicans, but don't you think there's a vast population of Republican wannabes out there who who would push back on that?
Push back?
Oh, totally. I think the people could fit. This is what I was talking about in terms of Trump's influence. If he decides, and the Republican Party does not take a strong stance about the events of yesterday now, that he wants to play a part, and I think he will, in primary elections against people and debates across the country about the next wave of Republican Congress people, I think he will, and I think he'll have probably a big effect, depending on what we see here. But I also think that this event, and it, of course, we're all in like a recency bias, right? Like this is the craziest thing we've seen in a crazy year and a half, right? But I think this will reverberate not just in the 2022 elections for Republicans, which all factors would have pointed to a wave year for them. It will have a significant impact on the progressive policy agenda, I think, in Congress. This has turned off in a way that maybe even Trump hasn't been able to. So such a broad swath of the American people that I think you're going to see a large swing back, and there's going to be a lot of room to move, especially for progressive policy priorities in Congress.
I would like to think that this opened up a big middle.
It has potentially destroyed entirely the, not entirely, has done significant damage to the Republican brand nationally at the state level and any policy priorities associated with it.
Yeah, but I mean, and to replace that, though, I'm imagining some sort of moderate Republican candidate or party that would fill the void, that if people would abandon the extreme politics of Trump, maybe there's room in the middle, which isn't a word I associate with progressive. Maybe I'm missing something here.
Well, see, what you may be missing here, John, is that the brutal reality of the Electoral College means that any third party effort has got to be strong enough to actually win states. And so if you take a party, if Republicans are thinking, how are we going to win back the White House? The Republicans have lost the popular vote, I think 7 of the last 8 presidential elections. To win the White House, they have to have a united Republican Party. And so if you say, okay, the moderate, you know, the fiscal conservative Republicans,
yeah,
the Illinois Policy Institute Republicans are, yeah, going to form their own party, they're just going to split the fiscal social conservative vote.
Sure.
And so they're not going to do that. We haven't had a replacement party since the Republicans took over for the Whigs.
I'm sorry, Eric, I'm not imagining a third party. I'm imagining a better version of the Republican Party. Don't you all know people who espouse a lot of Republican, at least fiscal values, but can't get on board the crazy train?
I do. Yes, totally.
But the point is the brand, there's an R at the end of people's name when they run. And if that brand is associated with the activity of yesterday, it's associated with Donald Trump and what he's done in the last week, that's a huge problem, regardless of, you know, your policy positions when you run.
I think Austin is right, because I would be surprised that if, you know, in every story that gets written from now for, you know, until time indefinite, Representative Bost and Representative Miller are going to be asked about their votes to overturn the Electoral College. So they are not going to be given, I would not, as a journalist, give them an opportunity to talk about infrastructure or broadband extension or anything else without pressing them on the vote to overturn a free and fair democratic election.
Okay.
I think that's Austin's point. Yeah,
but my answer to that, if I am their spokesperson, is I'm going to say this wasn't an attempt to overturn the election. It was an attempt to put a pause, to wait 10 days to look into these elections because we wanted to make
sure.
That's
not what they voted on. I mean, that is just literally not what they voted on. The Cruz thing for the commission never came to a vote. He never even introduced it.
But they're going to say that what they wanted to do was to take another look at this.
And I'm going to press them on that. Well, exactly what? And then it's 15 minutes later and they've either hung up on me or I've got a completely different other story than broadband extension or infrastructure improvement. So I think what Austin is saying is that the danger is that yesterday is going to serve as a quick and easy way for reporters to say, are you part of this? And I don't think that's inappropriate. I think that is warranted and as it should be.
I totally agree that it's appropriate. I'm just telling you to brace yourself for this constant tape loop of people saying this wasn't about the overturning the election. It was just about taking a more careful look at what happened. That's what they're going to say.
Now we're into what the media needs to do differently after Donald Trump. So we should have a separate emergency podcast that will go on.
Well, but I still don't know how I am not right about this. If the narrative plays out the way you guys are describing, it would still seem to me like that congressperson would have hell to pay in 2 years. If the media is incessant about it, spin it all they want the way Eric is suggesting it will happen, the voters would seem to me like you've opened up a lane, though, for a primary challenge to that Republican congressperson to say, I agree with a lot of the policies, but I didn't vote that way. And I'll be just as Republican as you want, but I won't have a T in front of my R. So let's give me a shot. That's the lane I'm imagining that the Republican Party could assume. And I think Trump did them a great favor by burning to the ground the Trump capital T party.
I made that point earlier, which was I think this is part of the beginning of the end of the Trump party. But Heather points out that there's no evidence of that so far, that in fact the Republicans this morning were cheering Trump and telling him that they love him. There's no reason to tell Donald Trump that you love him anymore because he's done unless you actually love him.
Heather, are you sure that that's what happened?
Yes.
Say that again. What the hell happened?
What specifically?
Everything. Wait, so Trump called in on a caucus of Republican what?
Yeah. Yes. So it's the Republican National Committee. They're having their annual meeting in Florida. He was scheduled to give a speech. He's not going to give a speech. So instead, he called into their breakfast meeting. And Ronna McDaniel, Mitt Romney's niece, I might add, put him on speakerphone. And he was greeted with cheers and calls of, we love you. And then he said, thanks for your support. We're, you know, going to make America great continually. And then he hung up. And I mean, that is straight from The Washington Post.
I would add, so Don Jr., of course, during that speech said that this is no longer, this isn't their Republican Party anymore, it's Donald Trump's Republican Party. And what I'm saying is, this is a critical juncture where leaders in the Republican Party can say definitively, it is not. And they have a very narrow window here. So that's all I'm saying. Like, mm-hmm. I think that it's a critical point right now to do that.
It is amazing to me that how quickly politicians do slide from the public stage. So you think about someone like Al Gore, right, who was like this. He won the popular vote. He came within 500 and whatever it was, 30 votes in Florida, being the president of the United States. And like a year later, he's growing a beard and he's like making documentaries and he's not a force in the party anymore. And I'm thinking that could easily happen to Trump, that people go like, oh, man, that was like a bad dream. That this crazy guy we had in the White House, and yeah, it was kind of fun and funny, and but that in 2 years, he's not going to be able to derail, say, Governor Kemp in Georgia right now, whose popularity numbers are down in the 20s, I think, after
and
Trump has been bashing.
That discounts the visceral emotional reaction some Republicans have with Trump as somebody they see as fighting back this wave of rising multiculturalism and rising power among women and rising power among, you know, gay people and non-binary people, you know, people they consider others. They see him for better or mostly for worse as somebody standing athwart that. I think the results of the Georgia Senate runoffs, I think, make it clear that without Trump on the ballot, Republicans have a really tough, challenge in meeting turnout that the Democrats have shown their ability to turn out in opposition to Trump. Now, does it all wash with Trump, you know, off center stage? Does Democratic turnout decline as well? Possibly. But we've talked on this podcast a lot about that emotional connection Republicans seem to have with Donald Trump. And I don't know that is going to fade away like it did, like, you know, support for Al Gore did, who chose to recede from the spotlight. You know, he said, you know, I'm not going to be a politician anymore. I'm going to do something else. We've never really in this country had in modern political history, had a president who lost and then said, but I'm not going away. And that's what we're facing right now.
We have not talked about what happened in Georgia and the fact that Mitch McConnell is no longer going to be the leader of the Senate. How surprised are you guys that those two seats flipped? Austin, are you?
No, for maybe three or four reasons. One, and this is the most important one. Your most important message to get out the vote in that race is that we're going to be a backstop for a radical left presidency and Congress. That message was undermined every single day by the person in the Oval Office saying that they're still the president, that there isn't going to be a Biden presidency because I am still the president. And that was hugely important, I think. And especially even if you look at the polling, it did seem to change significantly enough in the last 1 to 2 weeks of the campaign. And I think that is directly attributable to that. I think you also just the GOP got completely outworked by a lot of Democratic organizers and affiliated organizations. I think you had unimpressive candidates. I think all of those things combined led to a narrow victory.
Right. And it's worth pointing out that it's still very close. We're all watching TV on Tuesday night and they kept, seesaw back and forth.
It wasn't actually that close. I'm going to disagree with you there. So if Biden won the state by 11,000 votes, give or take, and Ossoff won the vote by three times that margin, and Warnock won his race by five times that margin, Warnock won by 2% and Ossoff won by 1.5%.
Okay, still relatively close. It's not exactly a landslide. But either way, I think the fact is that we are not looking at a socialist revolution in this country, that you have this 51-50 Democratic advantage with a moderate Democratic president and a bunch of senators like Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Hickenlooper and people like that who are just not going to get behind Medicare for all or probably giving college tuition payments and all those kind of things. You're just not going to see anything, I think, particularly radical coming out of the Democratic Party. You're not going to see them get rid of the filibuster. You're not going to see them endorse statehood for Puerto Rico or Washington, D.C. None of these things are going to happen because it's just going to be a fairly moderate mainstream next 4 years in all, or next 2 years anyway, in all likelihood. Do I have any disagreement on that?
I disagree about statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico. D.C. is probably more likely than Puerto Rico, but I think the events of yesterday make statehood for D.C. far more likely because part of the issue was that there was no local authority to call out the National Guard, and that got caught up with the president and the chain of command. And I think we heard Mayor Muriel Bowser call for it again today. And we, Biden has been on record supporting statehood for D.C. for many, many years. And I think that that is a possibility.
Wouldn't you have to get rid of the filibuster to do that, though?
No, not necessarily. You could do it as part of reconciliation.
Wow.
I don't know about all of that, Eric, but I know I was talking to Dick Durbin the next day, and since the Senate was 50-50, he was very excited about the Dreamers Act. He is sure hopeful that he'll finally get that passed.
I think DACA, and I think potentially even DAPA, the act that would have protected and given parents of Dreamers a path to citizenship is a real possibility as well.
And I can imagine a resignation or two on the Supreme Court going forward because now Biden will be able to choose somebody more to his liking. He's going to have to, again, he's going to have to get through the moderate Democrats in his party. But if he had not, if they had lost even one of those seats in Georgia, then Mitch McConnell might have just sat on a Supreme Court nominee for another 2 years.
Wait a minute. So somebody who might still be on the court yeah. when a new Republican becomes president, better to get out of the way and appoint a younger person? Is that what you're saying?
That could happen, yeah.
Yeah.
I would be very surprised if Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer didn't resign relatively soon. He's 82 years old and there's been reporting that he did not want to die in office like Ruth Bader Ginsburg did.
I think a lot of people in hindsight were wishing that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had resigned when Barack Obama was president just to forestall what Eric just described. Okay, let's leave Washington, D.C. and all of that for just a minute.
Can we share some breaking news with you a little bit still remaining in Washington, D.C.?
Sure, by all means.
The New York Times is reporting that President Trump is planning to pardon himself before leaving office.
I don't doubt the New York Times is a rule, but I wonder about that. So what does that mean? He's planning to. Hasn't he been planning to all along, or what, Heather? What are you reading about that?
There's been some reportings to suggest that one of the reasons that Attorney General Bill Barr resigned was because the president had signaled he planned to do this, and Barr said that he would not stand for it. So, you know,
Eric, you predicted it.
Eric's been right about a couple of things. He said there would be violence.
I was wrong about Georgia. I thought the Republicans were going to take Georgia. So I'm not going to boast about any of my predictive powers here. I think he is going to try to pardon himself, but I'm not sure that it's going to withstand a court test, because there's some language about giving a pardon and granting a pardon. Can you grant something to yourself? I don't know if they would actually put this pardon grant to the test. This would require, for it to actually become a relevant case, it would require a federal indictment of Trump that would then have to be tested at the Supreme Court level. I would think that it goes against the very idea of pardons and the pardon power to pardon yourself. But it would be an interesting test. He's also going to be facing some state level accusations that they're looking into him in New York. And I'm not sure that this is a good thing for him politically, to pardon yourself. That it's not a good look. Now, again, lots of things Trump has done are not a good look, and it hasn't managed to derail him totally.
Doesn't help the brand, though. We were talking earlier about the coattails for 2 years or 4 years down the road. If he pardons himself, I don't think that helps the team, does it? Wow. Okay, Heather. If any other news breaks. Eric, what else?
Well, I'm intrigued by this accusations against Father Flager, Father Michael Flager of St. Sabina. He's been there for many decades and has been an important figure in the African-American community. He's a white man, but he serves as a pastor at an all-black church, or nearly all-black church. And he's been a civil rights leader in town for a long time. And these allegations have just come up from 40 years ago that he had some sort of sexual abuse. Very unclear what the allegation is, but it was sexual conduct or abuse of a minor. And Flager has denied any wrongdoing. And the question that I have with something like this is, how do you litigate or prosecute or defend a charge that old when you've got something that, I mean, when it hasn't come to light in 40 years, that's going to be a real problem for Flager, for the church, for his accuser of figuring this out. It's why we have a statute of limitations on most crimes, which is like, how come you go back and say, well, where were you, you know, 40 years ago Thursday? Nobody remembers. Nobody knows. Few people even have any records. So it's one of those things where I don't know where you come down on that. A lot of people have said, well, I know Father Flager. He's a great guy. He wouldn't do this. But that's not necessarily evidence at all in a case like this.
That's not even the point.
He could be giving off a real creepy vibe and be innocent. He could be giving off a totally holy vibe and be guilty. That's not how this kind of crime works. So it's just, I mean, I don't have any answers here, but I think the questions are good ones.
If he did it and they could prove it, what do you think should happen then, Eric?
Well, he certainly should never work in the church again. Probably
should he go to jail?
If they can prove it, I mean, if they find video, or maybe he's, you know, written it down, something like that, then yeah. We do have, I think, the law has changed about statute of limitations on child abuse.
He faces no legal jeopardy.
None.
From this allegation. This is purely based on church law and the church's rules.
I thought we had lifted some statutes of limitations on child abuse or sexual abuse that's only come to light recently.
So essentially it can start the clock when there's been an allegation made to law enforcement. We do not know that an allegation has been made to law enforcement in this case. That might be a possibility, but I don't think that there has been. I think that probably would have come out by this point, but I don't know. Yep. So the question is whether Flager should continue to work in active ministry or not. That is the sole question here. And I got to tell you that I'm Catholic, and I gasped out loud when I saw this come across, because it is impossible to sort of quickly detail, you know, what his career has meant for both the church and Chicago politics. And I would encourage everybody to search up Evan Osnos's New Yorker profile from a couple years ago of Father Flager. I think it gets to sort of the heart of sort of the issues that he has confronted in Chicago. He's a very complicated man, and I think that in large part he sort of shaped Chicago over the last 40 years.
But a force for good.
You know, I don't know that I can say it is. He's just had an impact. I'm reluctant to say whether, you know, it has been wholly good or wholly bad, because, you know, so much of his legacy is complicated by issues of race and his relationship with Louis Farrakhan and his reluctance to call out Farrakhan's anti-Jewish comments. You know, also, I think you have to sort of, you know, examine his legacy in terms of not only fighting for social justice, but also addressing sort of the root causes of so much of the poverty in Auburn Gresham, where St. Sabina is. And, you know, there's so much to grapple with there.
I was so disappointed in the statement that the church put out, which they said, you know, we categorically dismiss these charges and we boldly stand with him because he did all of this good all of these years. And I thought, what an inconsiderate thing to do to somebody who may be a victim here.
And to, I mean, he was removed from the church, right? Pending during the investigation. So yeah, exactly. Why then why remove him? Just for optics, or that seems like the right thing to do? I thought
those are. You should not read any sort of, you know, like this has been sustained or it crossed some sort of threshold. If there is any allegation of sexual misconduct with a minor, the church's rule says you're done from active ministry during
the investigation. Right, understood. But the parish... But his parish said that we stand with him, that we deny the charges against him. Listen, I think that Father Flager's been a force for good. But to say that because of that, it's impossible to imagine that he did this 40 years ago. Evidently, these people haven't been reading newspapers for the last 20 years, because that's exactly what's been happening for 40 years.
You know, people are reluctant to believe allegations of sexual abuse and sexual misconduct when they are lodged against people that they know and who they consider, quote unquote, good people. We have seen this pattern time and time again. And, you know, it did not surprise me. It is not unusual. You also have to remember that St. Sabina, as a faith community, has seen Father Flager under attack from all sides for decades. Let's, you know, not forget, in 2011, Francis Cardinal George tried to remove Flager from the pulpit, and they basically forced him to leave him there, even though a typical Catholic pastor will only stay 12 years in one church. Flager's been at Sabina for 40 years, so it didn't surprise me.
So how does he clear his name, or how does the church validate the claims of this victim, this alleged victim, 40 years later? This is the question I have, which is like, you've sort of floated it out there. Hey, maybe he's a pedophile. And then a month, 2 months, a year later, they come back and go, well, we couldn't, yeah, who knows? Is that inevitable here? Were they like, well, we, you know, either we don't think so or we think so. Again, how do you litigate something like that?
The flip side of all of those decades of deference Catholic priests got from the archdiocese and the system and everything else, because there was this sense that we can't remove him from ministry, because if we do, we will be sending a signal that he is guilty. And what that did was left untold number of children in the path of predators. And, you know, I am more, you know, so that the Catholic Church has decided that they are willing to pay that price to, you know, a priest's reputation, to the church's reputation, if it means protecting children. Obviously, I don't know what the truth of the matter is here, but that is what the church has decided. And that, unfortunately, it's a zero-sum game. You can either leave a priest in ministry who has allegations against him, or you can remove him and go from there.
Right. I understand that. And the thing with Flager is that he is a regionally, if not nationally, famous person. He's not like a parish priest, Father Jones or something who mysteriously is gone for a while. This is someone whose reputation is probably shot at this point, and maybe deservedly so. I don't know how he ever decide something like that. But it's a tough situation when an allegation gets made, and you have to. You know, I don't know even what the threshold is for credibility before they say, "Well, we're gonna act on this." And it's a story. I did see something on social media where someone said that all the tumult in Washington, Father Flager was like the happiest person in Chicago because that story would have been just huge if it weren't for everything that was going on.
Earlier in the week, I thought we'd be talking a lot about the president's call that was captured and released to the Secretary of State in Georgia. When those two legal teams teed it up, I thought, boy, that's all we're going to have to talk about this week. We haven't even brought that one up here. It seems to now be kind of a moot point. But, yeah, there's been a lot that gets left on the sidelines, Eric. On the upside, on HBO Max, there's a real good show called Flight Attendant. And if you haven't watched the documentary about the Bee Gees, wow, is that terrific. Who wants to watch a documentary about the Bee Gees, kids? Nobody gets in the van. I'm telling you, you will be glad you got in the van. That's it.
Next week, we'll know about Madigan's speakership.
Yeah,
that's going to be what we'll know next episode.
Will we know? No.
We'll know what happened on the day he was supposed to be.
I thought it was.
He was supposed to be elected. The 13th is what we're looking at.
Okay.
So next Wednesday, we'll probably see a vote. Barring some kind of exceptional circumstance.
What's your prediction, Austin? Is Mike Madigan reelected to the speakership?
I don't have a concrete prediction.
Okay.
And I've studied this guy for years. I have followed the story really closely.
He said bad things about you personally.
I have strong opinions about his leadership.
Yeah. Wow. No
He's
prediction.
He's tried to attack me personally. He's tried to depose me and people that I care about. And I do not know what will happen. I think a lot can change between now and then. I think it's very unlikely he's elected. I'm comfortable predicting he will not be elected on the first ballot. After that, it's anybody's guess.
Well, I'm certainly in line with what Heather has said, that you can't beat somebody with no one. But now there are some more somebodies coming forward to challenge. I think there are three women now who've announced that they're candidates for speaker. And my sense is that the 19 who have said they will not vote for Madigan are going to stay strong. I'll say for at least 10 ballots. How's that?
Wow. 10 ballots.
I mean, you know, what's the record for the ballot? I mean, that's went on for days and days back in the 70s, I think. So
I can't help but note the symmetry that Mitch McConnell, who a lot of people thought had a stranglehold on the U.S. Senate for too long, no longer will. And wouldn't it be interesting if in the same election cycle, Mike Madigan lost his stranglehold in Illinois? We will have blue martinis at my house if that happens. That's it. Austin, Heather, Eric, maybe Lisa. Let's visit next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com.
We have a few bonus tracks now. Here's our conversation with Congresswoman Sherry Bustos, the Democrat from Central Illinois' 17th Congressional District.
I was on the House floor. We were starting the day in a way that really was meant to reinforce our democracy, to certify the Electoral College results. We knew that the Republicans were going to fight certifying those in some of the states, and so we knew at least legislatively we had a fight on our hands. But certainly we didn't think we'd have an armed mob that was trying to storm the House floor. So I was one of actually 26 Democrats on the House floor because of COVID. We're all socially distanced, and we were only allowed to have 26 members of the U.S. House of Representatives from the Democratic side, and the Republicans were to have 24.
How did you come to know that people were storming the gate, if you will? Did they come in when you were there, or did Secret Service notify you? What happened?
I was sitting about three rows back behind where Democrats were presenting our argument. All of a sudden, you could hear some rumblings outside. You know, it felt like it was getting louder and louder and louder, like, you know, just noises, people shouting and disruption. And of course, at this day and age, when you can look at your Twitter on your phone and you can actually look at television news as we're sitting on the House floor, I had Eric Swalwell was sitting to my left, and he was showing me what was going on outside. And he said, "And he said, this is at the Capitol. The speaker, Speaker Pelosi, was at the rostrum. We saw her escorted out. Probably felt like a couple minutes after that. We then saw Capitol Police escort our majority leader, and so then maybe a couple minutes later, Jim McGovern, a member of Congress from Massachusetts, who had stood in for the speaker at the rostrum, he said, "We need to pause for a moment." And then Capitol Police went to the microphone and told us that we should prepare to get on the floor. And you know, we didn't know exactly what was happening. And then you kind of don't know the time sequence. So I'm going to say, like, maybe a couple minutes later, they told us to grab our gas masks, which if you're sitting on the House floor, you can, it's below our seats is like a package, and that holds gas masks. And I can tell you that I'm in my fifth term in Congress, and if we were trained on how to use that, I don't ever remember it. Maybe I was as a freshman, which goes back to 2012, trying to figure out how to open a gas mask that is like sealed and looked like a Tupperware container.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to figure that out. And then it seemed like it was not too long after that Capitol Police began escorting us all out. We were supposed to get to this secure location, but there was a lot of confusion. Some of us ended up in one of the House office building's cafeteria. Some of us also ended up in a different House office building cafeteria, until police came again and got us and took us to our secure location, where we stayed for a number of hours until actually about 8 o'clock last night, when we made the right decision. House leadership made the right decision to go back into session,
mm-hmm.
As did the Senate leadership, so we could finish this work that was, again, the way we started our day to show how important our democracy is.
Were you witness to any of the violence? We understand, though we don't know many of the details, that four people passed away. A woman was shot. I don't know the circumstances of the other three people that died. Some police officers were injured. Did you see any of how any of that happened?
I was on the House floor while all of this was unfolding, and where the violence was growing. I can tell you this, the woman who was shot and died, was that happened literally right outside of the House floor. It is the hallway that I go down nearly any time I'm going to go speak on the House floor, anytime when, you know, in the mornings when we give our 1 minute speech or our 5 minute speeches, if we're talking about something important to our congressional district, those are the doors I pass every single time. And that is where this mob was storming into the Capitol building and trying to get onto the House floor. That was one of the entrances where there was violence that erupted. It's the door where, you know, the Senate leader walks through, the Speaker of the House walks through, the Escort Committee walks through on any State of the Union or on any joint session of Congress. Those are the very doors and the very windows on those doors that this mob, this angry, hostile, dangerous mob, was trying to get through, where our Capitol Police pulled their weapons and, guarded our safety.
Well, what do you say to those who do not believe that Joe Biden's victory is legitimate?
I think they're looking at their own political futures, thinking that they have to ally with this horrible president. And I think that they think if they don't tie their wagon to him and his supporters, that their own political futures are at stake. And I'll tell you this, I've said this many, many times, my integrity, my honesty, my reputation is never worth doing anything just to hang on to this seat. Every single one of the Republicans who have supported this should really, really think twice about staying silent. It, again, a very, very sad day. And everybody's got to take a look at themselves in the mirror and think about what they've done to lead to what happened on January 6, 2021, which will be a day in our national history, more than just a footnote, but really a sad, sad chapter.
Here's our conversation with Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy.
Where were you when all of this happened? Were you one of the Democrats on the floor, or had you then gone back to chambers?
I was in the chambers. I was about to head to the floor, and the Capitol Police basically came to my office and just shouted at the top of their lungs, "Get out, get out, get out." And we just had to kind of quickly get to the next secure location. And then from there, my staff said it's time to move again because the protesters had gotten much further into the Capitol complex than anyone thought. And then, I went to another secure location and ended up there about, I think, 7-8 hours. I lost track.
Yeah. What are you thinking or feeling about last night?
I think it was a mixture of pride, anger, sadness. Certainly there was a huge adrenaline rush as there was a little bit of a fight-or-flight response for a lot of us because we just didn't know the full extent of what was about to happen. Earlier in the day, we had seen the crowd starting to gather in D.C., and they looked a lot larger than we anticipated. But then I think when the president made his speech and he basically, told them to go to the Capitol and, quote-unquote, go wild, I thought that was kind of that was instigating the mob at that point. And I think we all saw the outcome, but it was a horrible assault on democracy.
I have two questions for you, Congressman. One is, what should happen to the people once we identify them that did storm the Capitol? And how interested are you in either removing President Trump for office via the 25th or impeachment again? Start with what should happen to the people that went into the Capitol. What's your thought about that?
Well, heck, it was more than 52 people. That's the number of people who got arrested. And so we have to track them down and bring them to justice. I think that there's going to have to be a massive investigation of what were all the security failures. The fact that, unfortunately, when thousands and thousands of people swarm the Capitol Police, it's hard to defend against it. But on the other hand, I saw a video of some of the Capitol Police taking selfies with these people and so forth once they breach the Capitol entrance, and that's just very disturbing. With regard to the president, I think yesterday reached kind of a new and kind of a new depth that we had not anticipated in terms of his behavior. I think there's a lot of people calling for his removal via either of those two mechanisms you talked about. On the other hand, he's leaving in 2 weeks, and I'm trying to, we're all trying to make sure that we can deploy maximum energies to, getting people vaccinated and repairing the economic damage of the pandemic, yeah. And all of our energy, in some regard, was directed toward that particular issue, Unfortunately, the pandemic is still with us today, John.
Your point being, you don't want to be distracted by trying to remove Trump from office with 2 weeks left. You'd rather, by the way, vaccinations in the nation's capital were postponed or canceled yesterday because of the unrest.
I
don't know if they're going to be able to get that back up and running. But every time a major American city says we can't vaccinate you, we lose lives. So I take your point, Congressman. I know you're a regular guest on our shows, and I'll ask you to join us again next week. I've got a lot of listeners that want to call in too, Raja. Any last thing you want to say?
I just want to say that today we have to remember, we might be Democrats and Republicans, but we're all on Team USA. And We have to put aside our differences and come together to achieve our full potential as Americans. And we saw what happens when we don't. And yesterday we saw the abyss. And it's a dark, dark place. No one wants to go.
Congressman Rajnar Krishnamurthy. Okay, Congressman, we'll visit again. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I'm glad that you are well and safe. Here's our conversation with South Suburban Congresswoman Robin Kelly, the Democrat from the 2nd Congressional District. Congresswoman, thanks for joining us. You're on WGN.
Thank you so much for having me. I just landed and got to my house, which I wanted to kiss the ground to be here.
Where were you yesterday when the protesters broke into the Capitol?
I was there in the Capitol. I was in the gallery of the chambers observing what was going on. And, you know, it was peaceful. We started getting a little text like that something was going on, but we were so insulated and isolated, we didn't realize. Then all of a sudden, they rushed Steny Hoyer out, Pelosi, Pence, Clyburn, and then we were hearing there was a breach. You might have to get under your chair. Then we heard, go get the gas mask. I mean, it was very scary. And they got the people on the first floor of the chamber out. But us, it was, you felt trapped because they locked all the doors. So the protesters couldn't get in, but that meant we couldn't get out. So we ran from the Democratic side to the Republican side. And by the time we got there, jumping over the stairs, under the rails and all that, we all hid behind the half wall because then the guns were drawn and they had the barricades up. It was very scary. I texted one of my children to let them know, you know, where I was. And we were down and hiding. And then there was a knock at the door and we didn't know if it was the Capitol Police or someone else, but it was the Capitol Police. So they finally got us out and then they shepherded us to behind, you know, downstairs behind little hallways and all of that. And then in running, we did see five of the protesters on the ground with guns pointed at them. And then they took us to an undisclosed area where we stayed for like 5 hours. Mm. So it was very scary.
I saw the photograph of the police with their guns drawn at those five people splayed out on the ground. Mm-hmm. But only five.
Yeah, they were on the third floor on the gallery.
I see.
Level.
Only 50 people have been arrested, though, so far. What do you think should happen to the people once they are identified that did break into the Capitol?
Go to jail. I mean, they should pay a price for this. Also, there should be an evaluation of the day and how the day was handled and what do we need to do, what we need to do different, what we need to do better, because that was some scary stuff.
I felt that the police at times were showing remarkable restraint, but obviously on the outset, there was a problem with the mob being able to gain access to the Capitol.
Exactly.
Do you have any idea how that was allowed to happen? How is it that there wasn't more of a force to push back at the very beginning?
I think from what I am told that when the mayor asked for more help, you know, they're not a state, that Trump did not allow that. But also, I don't know if the D.C. Police should have been there, if the state troopers from Virginia should have been there sooner, not after this happened. And much like I'm sure you're hearing, when Black Lives Matter was there, you know, they had it all together. And they needed to have it just together or more together with these people coming. And also, I don't think they, from what I heard on the news early this morning, that they thought it was going to be 20,000 people, and it turned out to be 30 or 40,000. One of the cops that I spoke to asked me, did I ever see the movie 300? And I said, yes, it's one of my husband's favorites. And he said, well, that's how we felt, 300 of us. 300,000 of them. You know, of course, it wasn't those numbers, but that hopefully they're learning a lesson, you know, for the next time, because mm-hmm. I don't want to go through that again. Staff, who I put before us, should not have to go through that again either.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, it's not just members of Congress that are there. There's
no.
a whole, there's thousands of people that work in that complex.
Yes.
And they and the police did not deserve to be pummeled or have their lives threatened. You suggested, Congresswoman, that the president suppressed the security because you said you heard that. I want to be on record here and say, on what authority are you hearing that? Is that just rumor or do you have a reason to suggest that?
No, I'm trying to think of what member I spoke to, one of my colleagues, and said that Muriel Bowser had asked for the D.C., I believe, National Guard, and she was turned down. And then another colleague told me that we asked the Department of Defense for help, and they turned us down. So I don't know if that's one and the same or what. I'm not really sure. And then that's when Maryland state troopers came, New Jersey state troopers, Prince George's County sent, I don't know if they sent their police. I'm not sure what they sent from Maryland, but I know they participated and helped us also.
Were you surprised that more Republican congressmen and women did not then change their vote on certifying the ballots? Many of them still voted to protest the electoral count.
Right. Less for Arizona, but actually more for
Pennsylvania.
It's so disappointing. You know, it's just they have been part, not everybody, but they've been a part of enabling the president and the things that he's done. And when we were all in the undisclosed location, it was Democrats and Republicans together. And, you know, Hakeem Jeffries, who is a fantastic leader, spoke. Liz Cheney spoke. She did a great job. And then one of the Republicans wanted to say a prayer. And I can't say on the air what some of the Democrats were saying, like, oh, you're going to say a prayer now? How hypocritical. We don't want to hear from you because, you know, all this rhetoric and, you know, adding fuel to the fire. And one of the Republicans asked me where I was, and I told him about the chamber and hiding and being worried about getting shot. And he said that, you know, he's so disappointed in his colleagues, especially a couple of them, because they incited this, you know, along with the president. And people could have really gotten hurt. And, you know, it's just ridiculous. It's shameful. Like I said, I don't love to fly, but I was so happy to get on that plane and land in Midway this morning.
We're glad that you're back. Our best to your staff as well. And we really appreciate your service. And thank you for joining us today on WGN Radio.
Thank you so much. Be safe.